Hey, it's Jamila. I just wanted to pop back into your feeds real quick to bring you this really cool conversation that Clara Jeffrey had this summer with Jake Tapper. Clara, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, and Jake Tapper is a host at CNN. And this time, Jake is talking about his new novel. It's a book called The Devil May Dance. This conversation was produced by our partners at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco. Enjoy.
It's my pleasure to welcome Jake Tapper. He's the anchor and chief Washington correspondent at CNN, where he hosts both a weekday show and a Sunday show. He's also the author of a new novel, The Devil May Dance. It's a sequel to his bestseller, The Hellfire Club, which is being adapted into a TV series by HBO Max. We're going to talk about historical fiction, but also about politics and media. Jake, welcome. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Been a long time since I saw your face.
Very long time. You know, a lot of the things that we're going to discuss today are sort of an interesting Venn diagram between truth, lies, and fiction. So let me start off by asking you about some news you made when you told Kara Swisher of the New York Times that Republicans who push the election fraud conspiracies are not welcome on your show. And you estimated that's about a third of the caucus, which, to be honest, seems low.
No. It's two-thirds of the House caucus.
Two-thirds of the House caucus. All right. In any case, how did you arrive at this decision?
Well, to be completely candid, it's not a decision and it's not a policy. I haven't booked any of the liars since the election. And I just started recently, in the last few weeks, talking publicly about it. It's not a policy. I mean, if one of them wanted to come on the show, I would talk about it with my team. And I would want to talk about the election lies, obviously, not just as a throwaway at the end, but as a focus. I respect that there are other people who do it differently, who think that the way to do it is to press them on the lies, etc. Although I haven't really seen a tremendous amount of interviews like that. I just think that we in the media need to be having the conversation. And since I pretty much alone haven't booked any of these people, I started talking about it publicly because people started noticing it and I didn't want to be coy about it. I think it's important to book Republicans and I think it's important to book conservatives. And I just had Congressman Mike McCall, the chief Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee on my show today to talk about his view of Biden and Russia. And I think that's important. But the election lies are not a difference about tax policy. It's not a personally different, disagreement about a social issue. The election lies are lies. It's no less true than saying, I mean, no less a lie than saying that the moon landing was faked or that the Holocaust didn't happen or that Bush knew about 9/11 and let it happen. These are offensive ideas. Generally speaking, society treats them as such. This one was offensive from the very beginning. And the reason was, when Trump started lying about this before the election, he started setting the stage for it when it was obvious what was going to happen, that Biden could very well win, according to the polls, and that it was going to be a close election, especially in some states, and that Democrats were using absentee ballots, et cetera, et cetera. I don't care if Donald Trump hurts Joe Biden's feelings. That's not what's at stake here. What's at stake here is violence. And, Gabe Sterling, the Georgia Republican election official, very conservative Republican, in December, early December, I think December 6th, in fact, was warning about this. He was saying someone's going to get killed. He was worried about his election workers who were getting death threats because of the lies that Trump was saying. And then a month later was the insurrection. So,
yeah, it turned out we had to worry about Mike Pence as well.
Yeah. Hang Mike Pence. And we had to worry about Mitt Romney. We've seen the video now of Mitt Romney running down the hall. I mean, who knows what would have happened? Look, people lost their lives that day. And there are lots of brave Capitol police officers and Metropolitan D.C. police officers who have PTSD, who are shell-shocked, who are some of them are wounded, maimed for life But the truth is, we're lucky that more people didn't die. Four people who were part of the mob died. Officer Sicknick died afterwards. We're still not sure why. His family thinks that it had to do with that day, but the medical examiner couldn't find any evidence of that. Two police officers died by suicide in the days after. I mean, this is a body count. This is what people were worried about. And so I think that it is incredibly derelict for journalists. While it is easier, it is derelict for journalists just to pick up and move on.
So Chris Wallace was one of those who, when asked about this, you say it's not a policy, but a history thus far. Yeah. He characterized it as moral posturing and said that the way to deal with this kind of a thing is to have them on and grill them about it. You say that you're not seeing that much of it. And I wonder why you think that is. Is it a format issue? Is it a moral courage issue? What do you diagnose the problem to be?
It is not fun. It is not easy. It subjects you to attacks from Republicans because Donald Trump so successfully convinced so many millions of Americans that facts are a partisan issue. There's a whole group of people like the Elise Stefanik and the Josh Hawleys of the world that will attack you for standing up for the facts about the election. I have yet to see Kevin McCarthy or Elise Stefanik or Steve Scalise or Josh Hawley or Ted Cruz, who I would consider to be the five basically who kind of led this effort. Like Stefanik is a new addition to the House leadership, but she certainly was a willing participant, and that's why she's in the position she's in now. She's more liberal than Liz Cheney. She voted with Trump less often than Liz Cheney. She just happens to be with Trump on this, on the lie. Have any of them been held to account for their election lies? For Kevin McCarthy saying right after the election that Donald Trump won the election in a landslide. For Steve Scalise signing on to that truly deranged Texas Attorney General lawsuit that tried to disenfranchise four states, just cancel their electoral votes. And I don't know how many of the people who signed on to it. It's about, I don't know, I think it's about 130, 140 members of the House Republican Caucus. I don't know how many of them read it, but it's crazy. It's crazy stuff in there. It's not just like, there's a difference between being critical. I don't like how states changed their election laws and played fast and loose because we were in the middle of a pandemic. Like there's a way to do that. Mm-hmm. That's not to me election lying. I have concerns about how that was done. Like you're not saying that Joe Biden's illegitimate. You just don't like how states did that because of the pandemic. But this is crazy stuff. I haven't seen any of one of these five grilled at all, literally at all by this. Have you? I mean, I'm happy to correct myself, but I haven't seen any one of those five be really asked tough questions over and over in an interview about this.
I wonder what you would say to this theory that I'm going to put out that historically politicians go on cable news shows, Sunday shows, radio interviews to spin something to put out their positions, whatever that is. And so now when confronted with, you know, lies and just bizarrely deranged theories that they're putting forth, that it's very hard for the sort of apparatus around producing these shows to adjust. You're an exception. And I wonder, even within your own network, how that's being received.
I mean, I'm given the leeway to do what I want to do. Everybody has different ways of doing it. There are many anchors for whom I have tremendous respect who are doing it differently. Maybe they think all you need to do is have the person on, ask a few questions about whatever the issue of the day is. And God knows there are important issues of the day. And then they ask a few questions and, you know, and they think that that's good enough. And I'm not saying that I have the answers on this. I don't know. I am just saying as genuinely as I can, and it would be much easier if I did not feel this way. It would be much easier to book the shows. It's much easier to get along, to go along in Washington, D.C. There are people who went along with this lie that I liked, that I had had on my, that, you know, that I have had on my shows before to talk about important issues, but I can't get behind it. If one of these people said, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have done that, I shouldn't have signed on to that lawsuit, I shouldn't have voted to disenfranchise the millions of legal voters who cast their ballots in Arizona and Pennsylvania, I shouldn't have done that, I shouldn't have told those lies or whatever, I honestly would say, okay. And then I would be able to, I honestly would then book that person. I really would. I don't want, it's not fun. This really kind of sucks. I am just saying right now in June, 2021, I feel really uncomfortable about the idea of just letting these folks walk away from this as if what happened on January 6th didn't happen, as if they played no role. And also listen to Liz Cheney, listen to what she's saying. She is very clearly saying, although I'm going to say it more clearly than she does, because she's kind of, I mean, she's already, it's tough what she's going through. She is saying they tried to steal the election once, they're going to try to do it again. That's what she's saying very clearly, at great professional cost. She lost her leadership position. She may never be elected president. She might lose her House seat. And I'm sure it's not fun to be in Wyoming for her.
Yeah, I would imagine. So we've touched on lies. We'll come back to more lies. But I just wanted to ask you a sort of professional jealousy question, I guess. You know, you're the lead anchor of CNN. You have two shows. You had to be on hand for all the craziness that was, you know, on call for whatever 2020 threw at us and early 21. You have two kids. How in hell did you find the time to write this book?
Well, first of all, I have an incredibly supportive spouse. So that's, you know, really important. And my kids are old enough now that the time, they're 11 and 13, that they want to spend time with me, but they don't want to spend all too much time with me, you know.
Yeah, yeah, so, I'm familiar.
Yeah, you know. So, but I will say this. I mean, you know, I wrote this book in about, it took about 2.5 years. So it wasn't like it just happened. But I will say that, first of all, I find the outlining process very helpful when it comes to writing. And so, for example, like I'll, you know, okay, I'm on chapter 13 today. Here is what it says in the outline to write. And like, then I'll do that. So that helps. And then the writing program is like a diet or like an exercise routine or anything like that. You just have to make a rule and stick to it as much as you can. And for me, the rule is try to sit down every day and write, even if it's just for a minimum of 15 minutes, because anybody can find 15 minutes in their day over breakfast, lunch, dinner, right before you go to bed, whatever. And if all you do is 15 minutes a day for a week, that's an hour, 45 minutes, that's 3 or 4 pages, and it adds up. So that's really the rule. But I will also say that I wrote a lot of this during the pandemic, and as excruciating and awful a time it was for all of Americans and everybody worldwide, and as tough as it was for journalists too, because we had to, like, we couldn't turn, look away. We had to stay abreast of everything. I did the show from my house from April to August. I found myself with a lot more time than I'd ever had in my life.
So you're making the case for remote work? Well, the lack of commute is the key to a novel? I mean, I think that's reasonable.
The hour and a half, 2 hours of commute gone. I'm not going to say that there's a lot of time spent in the office that's wasted, but there's a lot of time spent in the office that's wasted. I think anybody who's ever worked in an office knows that there's a degree of hanging out time and meetings time. And there was something about the pandemic that made meetings, at least for me, and I hate meetings. I had far fewer meetings, no birthday parties I had to pop by in the kitchen. I had more time on my hands. I really did. And I had a desire to escape the reality of what we all went through.
It's interesting. I was just about to ask you, the first book was set in DC in the McCarthy era. And, you know, your protagonists are the same in both books, this couple, Charlie and Margaret Martyr. But what made you choose to set this book in, you know, Vegas and Hollywood in 62?
I heard this amazing story, and I heard it right around the time that I realized that the book that people were buying, the first book, The Hellfire Club, and that I was going to, if I wanted to, I was going to be able to write a second one. And I just heard this amazing true story, which is something so amazing, I don't think I could have ever concocted it, which is Sinatra, which I'm sure your the attendees tonight know, was one of the biggest stars in the world. And the Rat Pack, which were his best friends, who were also the biggest stars in the world. And it's hard to explain to younger people. The best way I can explain it, and this falls short too, because this isn't even like a good, this is maybe like a millennial reference, definitely not Gen Z, but the Rat Pack was so big that they made a really crappy movie called Ocean's 11, and everybody saw it. And it's not a good movie. It's really awful. It was just so they could go hang out in Las Vegas and screw around. Not that they needed a reason anyway, but the remake of Ocean's 11 by Soderbergh is, you know, like almost everything Soderbergh does, just absolutely brilliant. And it stars the biggest stars of its time, George Clooney and Brad Pitt and Matt Damon and Don Cheadle and Julia Roberts. What you have to understand about the Rat Pack is, imagine if all those guys, Clooney and Damon and all, imagine, and Brad Pitt, imagine if they could all sing as well as act, and imagine that they're all best friends. Like, that's what the Rat Pack was like, this just incredible constellation of stars. So anyway, they worked their hearts out to get Senator John F. Kennedy elected in 1960, when Sinatra thought that the President Kennedy would come stay with him when he came out to California. I mean, the Rat Pack did a lot for him, and it was a very narrow election. And also, a member of the Rat Pack was married to Kennedy's sister. So he started having all this work done to his estate, to the compound in Rancho Mirage, right near Palm Springs. It's about 2 hours. Well, you guys know, it's about 2 hours outside of LA. So he had rooms put in, he had phone lines installed, he had a helipad constructed. This is, I didn't make this up. This all happened. And then Attorney General Robert Kennedy, who was going after organized crime, it was pointed out to him, and he hated organized crime. I mean, he worked against it when he was a Senate staffer. And there was a famous showdown he had with Sam Giancana, the Chicago mob boss. Anyway, it's pointed out to him when he's attorney general. I mean, I think he was like 36 or something. You know, Sinatra, who's friends with your brother, the president, is friends with Giancana, right? So can you really let your brother stay at Sinatra's house? So Robert Kennedy had this dilemma. Do I insult one of the biggest stars in the world, a friend of my brother's who helped get my brother elected through ways known and secret, or do I let my brother sleep in a bed where mobsters have slept? So when I heard that story, I'm like, first of all, I said, how have I never heard this story before? And then I said, well, I need to have Charlie and Margaret go into that, because that's just amazing as it is. And I can keep playing with the Kennedys, and now I can add the Rat Pack, and it just sounds fun. I mean, it was a lot of work too, but it just seemed like it would be fun.
What was the funnest part to research? I mean, you get into the mob, you get into the Rat Pack, you get into the Scientologists. What was the most fascinating or just a good time to read up on?
Some of the best books of that era. There's some magnificent books about members of the Rat Pack. Nick Tachis wrote the most beautiful one called Dino. It's like Dino, the Dirty Business of Dreams or something like that. But it's just so good. The late Nick Tachis. But some of the most enjoyable ones are the ones by some of like the smaller characters, like Judith Exner, who had an affair with Giancana and others. She wrote a book that came out in 1977 and kind of disappeared, I'm sure, with people pulling strings.
But it was catch and kill of its day.
I mean, it was published, but I think it went straight to paperback. I'm sure there was some pressure on networks to not touch it. I'm sure there had to have been, because it's so insane, this book she wrote. And then George Jacobs, who was a valet of Sinatra's. Just reading about the era is incredible. There was so much that was interesting. I'll tell you what was most surprising to me, just thinking about race. There's a lot about how women are treated in Hollywood, and there's also a lot about race in Hollywood, because of Sammy Davis Jr. obviously is a character in the book. But first of all, Sinatra was really progressive on civil rights issues, like in the 40s and the 50s. I mean, forcing Vegas hotels to integrate, demanding that African-American members of the band were paid the same. In today's context, it's not that big a deal, but in 1950, it was pretty revolutionary. The Kennedys also, one of the other things that was interesting to me was that Sammy Davis Jr., I never really thought about it, but his wife was white, which was very uncommon in 1960. The Kennedys, and I don't know whether John or Robert knew about it, certainly Ambassador Kennedy, leaned on the Rat Pack for Sammy Davis Jr. to delay his wedding until after the election. I mean, that's how messed up this world was. Even super huge stars like Sammy Davis Jr. were being pressured by the Democratic nominee to delay his interracial marriage. And even then, he wasn't asked to perform at the inaugural ball because he had a white wife. It makes a little bit more sense why Jackie Robinson endorsed Dick Nixon in 1960.
You know, I had this experience reading the book that I would stop every few pages to Google things. Right. You know, I feel like an interactive version of it should be available at some point. But, you know, your protagonists move kind of Zelig-like through just a world chock full of real celebrities, all the names you just mentioned and many, many others. It's a real who's who of 1962. And I was kind of intrigued to think about, like, your job as a journalist is to unearth truth about powerful people. When you put on your novelist hat, you're also inventing some tales about them. And just tell me how you thought about that tension.
It is a tension. You're right. And it's one that I struggled with in the first book and the second book, because I'm making stuff up about real people. In between the first draft and the second draft of the first book, The Hellfire Club, I became a little bit more comfortable with, and I made Joe McCarthy a bigger character in the book. And if I could do a third draft of it, I would make him an even bigger one. And in fact, in the TV show that we're working on, me and Mark Smith, who wrote The Revenant, I said, I wish I could do a third draft and I'd make Joe McCarthy an even bigger character. In the second book, I'm more comfortable with it. And that's why Sinatra is arguably the third biggest character in the book after Charlie and Margaret. You have to just let yourself make stuff up because it's a novel, but you try to be true to the idea. You try to be true to the essence of the person. You know, you can't have Frank Sinatra like open his shirt and he's Spider-Man. In fact, somebody asked me the other day, you know, is there anybody from that era that I wanted to have in the book as a bigger, you know, that I didn't. And there is, and it's Marilyn Monroe. She appears a few times in the book. I never could figure out a way to get her into the book in a way that didn't feel, even though the book is all kind of gimmicky, I never could figure out a way to do it that rang true.
You know, sometimes historical fiction, whether it's in printed form or in films, can kind of end up being the received history of a moment or a person, even though it, you know, is not a strictly historical work. And I'm,
like, I can see Alaska from my house, which Sarah Palin never, or I can see Russia from my house, which she never said, and is probably her best known quote. And she never said it.
Absolutely. And, you know, in this book, The Hellfire Club was written further back in the Trump era when we, you know, had already gotten into the world of alternative facts and everything, but probably wasn't quite as obvious just how much of a sort of post-truth era we are in. Without giving away too much, you know, we have the Church of Scientology up to some not such good things. We have human trafficking kind of at the center of the book. I'm wondering on kind of both those topics, you know, given how much the sort of moral panic over human and child trafficking has become such a part of QAnon, for example, was that more interesting to explore? Did it make you uneasy at moments when you were exploring that, wondering, oh man, is Jake Tapper's version of history going to blot out the sun?
I think it's more Epstein than QAnon in terms of the trafficking angles. Like, in other words, like reality-based. And we can't pretend that it's still not a part of the life of some, you know, very wealthy and powerful men that, I don't know what of the allegations against Congressman Matt Gaetz. I don't know what's true. I don't know what's not true. I don't know what's going to hold up in court, but there has certainly been many allegations about a scene in Florida where women are encouraged to come and party and have things paid for. And that's, it's 2021, still going on. So I did feel like exploring that was important, especially because, you know, the book was taking place in Hollywood, I wanted Margaret to have her, you know, generally the way these books work is I give Charlie kind of like a mystery to solve and Margaret gets one too. Or Margaret has her own mystery. Like they're both, he's kind of the main protagonist, but she's kind of the hero. So it's like they have these kind of like joint, you know, parallel adventures. And yes, I definitely thought about Epstein, which is a real, see the thing about QAnon, first of all, let me just say, there's nothing unrighteous about caring about child sex trafficking or sex trafficking in general. I mean, it's a horrible major problem in this country, all over the world. I don't see any evidence that these people are actually concerned about it. It's not like they've turned on Matt Gaetz, right? I mean, like,
right. No, it's a partisan, yeah, I mean, a partisan filter for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a number of, and you can find them, former Trump, and I'm not blaming Trump for it at all, but there are people who, you know, have been affiliated with the Trump campaign or the Trump White House or the Republican Party who've gotten in trouble for child pornography or trafficking or whatever. And I mean, you just have to Google it. It's right there, the arrest reports. And I see nothing about QAnon caring about any of that.
Let me ask you about, in some ways, maybe the highest wire you were on in this book, you invented a Sinatra song, the title of the book is the title of the song. And it's not in the book, the lyrics are sung and therefore written on the page, intercut with an action scene.
Yeah.
And, I don't know how vicious the Sinatra fan base is these days, but I wondered what you did to sort of, you felt pretty sure that these are in the style and the manner of lyrics that Sinatra would have sung.
So when I wrote The Outpost, which is a nonfiction book about Afghanistan, there was a scene where one of the guys and his whole unit were, they were driving into Afghanistan. They're driving north in Afghanistan and they were cranking up AC/DC. And there was another scene at the end of the book after the big battle where eight of their brothers died. This is all true story, where they're singing Johnny Cash songs. I had to take out everything except for one line because the attorneys for Little Brown, and I'm sure it's the same for every publishing house, said, you can't quote more than one line or we'll get sued for copyright infringement, period. And then the same happened when I wrote The Hellfire Club and I tried to use songs from the time to set a tone, set a scene.
So this is like frustration over the limits of fair use?
Yep.
I love it.
Entirely. It was like, there's more than one song in there that's made up, by the way. The first of all, thank you for reading the book. Not everybody who does one of these actually reads the book, so I appreciate it. The scene at Disneyland where Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawford sing a wacky song about the Cuban Revolution, like a cheesy, like kind of embarrassed, like that I wrote up, that I made up. And then there's another time that Peter Lawford and Charlie are driving to the compound in Rancho Mirage and there's like a Sinatra song comes on the radio. That's just a paragraph or something, but I made that up too. Yeah, and the lawyers called me up and they're like, Tapper, we've been through this. Now, this is the third book. You can't quote more than a line from a song. You have an entire scene with an entire song intricately woven into this action scene at the climax of the book. And I'm like, I wrote the song. It's not a real song. It's not a real Sinatra song. And then my editors made me put at the end of the book to make sure that nobody went mad Googling that I made it up.
More from Clara and Jake after this. Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give.
Thank you.
Let's tune back into this conversation with Clara Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, and Jake Tapper.
You and I both got our start, or more or less, at the same alternative weekly Washington City paper. We were there at slightly different times. I'm wondering,
were you there under Jack Schaefer? When were you?
I split my time between Jack Schaefer and David Carr.
Oh, that's great.
I'm wondering how that time helped inform the rest of your career.
Well, David Carr was an incredible editor. And if I'd known how little time we were going to get with him, I probably would have taken advantage of it more. So I was doing PR and kind of figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. And I started doing freelance journalism. And then he took me to lunch to that French restaurant in Adams Morgan that he loved. I forget the name of it, but you know what I'm talking about. And yeah, it was the first time I ever saw snails, not in a garden. And he convinced me to quit my job and take a huge pay cut and become a journalist, hop on his pirate ship. One of the things he did was he wrote the press column while being this amazing editor. He wrote the press column and he would take on the Washington Post in this fearless way. Because like every writer in Washington wanted to work for the Washington Post, everyone. And Carr was like crapping all over them righteously in the best way possible, which is like not with opinion, with reported analysis. The world is so deprived of his voice, not covering the era we're in. He went on to become the media writer for the New York Times. I would just love to see him making sense of our media now, making sense of Trump world. My roots are City Paper and I'm really proud of it.
You know, it's, I think we're both bereft that alt weeklies, have really kind of taken it on the chin the last past couple of decades. Or, you know, most of them are closed. The ones that are left are mostly not where they used to be. And honestly, that's true of a lot of journalism. Yeah. And I'm wondering what part of it worries you the most.
I mean, the stuff that David Simon talks about, that who is going to go to the Baltimore City Council meetings, because it's not going to be CNN, it's not going to be the New York Times, it's not going to be Mother Jones. Like, who's going to do it? Like, it has to be the Baltimore Sun or the Baltimore City Paper. It has to be. That terrifies me. The politicians in Washington are probably less crooked than as a general rule than the ones in state capitals and cities and counties all over the country, just because there's so much oversight. I worry about like what's going on in Harrisburg, you know, what's going on in Trenton. But, you know, it's not just the local newspapers and the local free weeklies. It's local television stations, too.
Yeah. And I think it's also that, you know, things like CNN and the New York Times rely either on the talent pool that comes up through those places or the file footage. I mean, you know, or whatever, like the reporting that's done locally, you may not live in that location, but if it's important enough, it gets to the national news, but not if it's never told.
Yeah. I mean, we need great investigative journalists all over.
You know, every profile that I've read about you has described you as being very confident from a young age. And
I think you know me well enough to know that I have plenty of insecurities.
What do you think for you, at least in your public persona, which came first, the confidence or the accomplishments? Like, how did you gain confidence? And what would you say to young journalists who are maybe a different gender or a different race, what would your advice be to kind of seize that confidence?
First of all, I'm plenty insecure. I mean, you know, like any other human being on the planet. But that said, I think one of the things, and this is, I say this to young people constantly, because I don't think anybody prepared me. So I want young people to know this, and young people who are any color, any race, any gender identification, any whatever, any ethnicity, especially in journalism, but in anything, there is a lot more rejection out there than you have been raised to believe there is in life. There is some rejection here and there. Maybe you didn't get the part you wanted in the school play, or maybe the boy you liked or the girl you liked didn't like you back or whatever. You didn't get into the fraternity you wanted. But generally speaking, you get a lot of what you want. And there are like, there's a cocoon around you. There are like people, there are people in college whose job it is to, like, your resident advisors, right? Who their job is to make sure that you're doing okay. But then you go into the real world and it is, it can't, for me, at least it was harsh because it's not like it's, and it's tough not to take it personally, but like, it's not, it's just a different world and people just need to be ready to be rejected. Every successful person you see in journalism, every one of us has been rejected so many times by so many people. It's just part of it. And you just have to think of it like you're going to make it. I think there has probably never been a better time to be a woman journalist or a journalist that's who's Black or Latino or Asian. That I'm not saying that it's easy. It's still much easier to be a white male journalist. Don't get me wrong, but people are at least now like aware that, you know, it's part of the conversation in a way that it wasn't when I was coming up.
What part of your job do you enjoy the most?
The truth of the matter is I love doing my show. I love having, like we do, I feel like we do a really good show. Like we cover news from all over the world. I love not having to cover whatever you think of Trump. And I'm not saying he should have been elected or reelected or whatever, but like him not being in the White House and not like doing crazy tweets or having like everybody just like constantly reacting to the disrupting he's doing, means that like I now have time in my show to do a piece about foster care in America or to do a piece with somebody about the elections in Nicaragua. I'm proud of that.
Is it, I mean, that's an entire show, but of the sort of particular pieces, do you love grilling someone? Do you love the sort of research process leading up to a great segment? Is there a part that particularly charges you about the making of any one show?
I mean, when I have a good interview with somebody, like a good tough interview with somebody, it's fun. I like doing like
Stephen Miller, perhaps. That was a sort of a that was a classic.
That was a long time ago. I feel like, but that wasn't pleasant. I would have really honestly preferred him to have been just like a normal human being and like answer my questions. But he was performing for his audience of one. I haven't watched it. I did Fresh Air a few years ago and they played me a chunk of the interview. And I couldn't believe in retrospect how patient I was with him. I really do like calling out the lies. I worry about our democracy. In a way, I worry more than now than I did before. I think people don't really fully understand how close we came to the election being stolen.
Well, and how they're setting up to enshrine the ability to do it again.
That's what I'm worried about, because now they're changing laws in states like Georgia to make it so it will be easier for a state legislature to overturn the will of a Secretary of State whose job it is, like Brad Raffensperger, who abided by the law and stuck to the facts and now may well not be reelected. I think people don't fully understand necessarily that if like 15, 20 different people were in those positions, the election would have been stolen. And I don't know what would have happened. I mean, would there have been another civil war? I mean, what would have happened?
Well, let me ask you what was happening at the network when that was going on. I mean, journalists covering it were aware of the peril that it was coming down to a very.
I mean, we were calling it as we were laying it straight as it was during that time saying it. I don't know what they were saying it on other networks, but we were just saying what was happening. I'm afraid of what's going to happen next time. I mean, I was afraid before.
I think what's interesting about this moment is that, yes, Trump still holds sway and they're all worried about being primaried and mean tweets or mean, you know, email missives, whatever tool he's using at his disposal now that he's killed his failing blog. But they're doing it nonetheless. It's not, you know, it's maybe at his behest, but in a much more attenuated way. So there's not this sort of, oh, I didn't see that tweet. Oh, I don't know what he's doing. I don't really believe him. And I think that's a scary new moment for the country that I am not sure people fully understand either, maintaining power at kind of all costs.
I mean, you just have to look at Liz Cheney, who is somebody I'm sure that you agree with nothing. I would agree with her about almost nothing, but you just have to look at what she did. And like this whole idea, I mean, it's such a joke when the MAGA people say like Liz Cheney did that to be popular at cocktail parties or whatever. What cocktail parties? Like, who's having cocktail parties? And even then, when there were cocktail parties, I never saw Liz Cheney at a cocktail party. I mean, I don't go to many of them anyway, but like, it's all such nonsense. There's no upside for Liz Cheney other than she can sleep at night. That's it.
This, I've been weaving in questions from the audience all along, but I think this is a good one to end on from somebody in the audience, you know, who's basically asking a question I'm sure you get a lot and I get a lot, but with everything with our country being so divided politically, what gives you hope that we could come closer together, or are you in a sort of ebb of hope at the moment?
I'm never without hope for this country, and other countries have their problems too. It's not like I look at any other country and say, well, they've got it figured out.
Maybe New Zealand, but yes.
I think that, you know, it's a time for politicians to really think about what's more important, their own individual pursuit of power or the country. Look, I'm not a liberal Democrat. I'm not like advocating that Joe Biden be reelected. I mean, I think it's important that these very nefarious lies be called out.
Well, Jake, I want to thank you very much. CNN anchor and author of The Devil May Dance, which we encourage you to pick up at your local bookstore, which you can go back to now, almost everywhere.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to watch more virtual programs or support the Commonwealth Club, please again, visit commonwealthclub.org. I'm Clara Jeffrey. Thank you, everyone. Take care. And take care to you, Jake.
Thank you so much. And you did a wonderful job. Thanks for reading the book. And thanks for being a great moderator that asked great questions.
Thank you.
Jake Tapper from CNN. His new novel, The Devil May Dance, is out now. Thanks to our partners at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco for producing this. We'll see you soon.
This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.